Except this one's live. I don't find myself complimenting the Times very often, but they published a letter this week. Since it's the Grammy night, everybody's watching the Grammys, except you smart people that are watching me. A letter in which a mother said her 10-year-old, who saw the Super Bowl halftime, Jackson, whoever that other kid is, thing, said, well, if Janet Jackson wants to get attention, her 10-year-old said this, if Janet Jackson wants to get attention, why didn't she just sing better? 10-year-old wisdom. 10-year-old wisdom. You know, I could be persuaded tonight to pull out Joseph Heller again, God knows, and his humorous portrayal of David in Cynicism, a novel. David was a great musician, and since it's music attention night, I could read David's assessment as he tells it, the history of his own people, particularly Abraham. I didn't get to Abraham the other night. He's got a nice rendition of what David in this novel thinks of Abraham. We saw that he didn't think too much of Moses. He thought his lines were better than Moses' lines. I can be persuaded to see what David thinks of Abraham, just as a little salute to the music industry by the greatest musician of biblical times. But I'm not going to do anything if I don't get some phone calls from my people. I want to know whether you're watching breathlessly at the Grammy Awards or whatever they call it, or whether you're watching me. We will play about 9:30, thereabouts. We will take you into the service as it happened today in the cathedral. You'll miss the 30 best minutes that went on in a previous service, but I will take you to the cathedral and for today's message. And I'd like you to start right now, which tells me your response to being in the cathedral today. You'll be making your reservations today for next Sunday, so get on the telephone. Okay, no more calls for a while. Finish the calls you have, be courteous. I'll open the phones in the next half hour. Last Sunday night, I read from Joseph Heller. Here he is. He's got a happy look about him. He wrote Catch 22. Something happened. Good as gold. Author of the play We Bombed in New Haven. Probably all the bookstores that have it, it's not a current book, so you probably weren't able to find it. It was published a long time ago. That means it's 20 years old. I'm sure it's all sold out. You've been trying to get it. Amazon probably ordered out by now. But you probably read it. You that got it. It's a novel. And it's written through the eyes of David in his old age, when he's still mooning over Bathsheba, and Bathsheba only wants Solomon to be king. And they've given him this young virgin that's supposed to warm his old bones up. But doesn't work. Abishag, the Shunammite. So he's reflecting on his life, and he's PO'd at God. That's a novel. It falsely characterizes David. Let me say that bluntly. All you have to read is Psalm 51 to see David's true attitude toward God. But this is proof that the same words bring life to some and death to others. And I do what, I mean, I can see most preachers saying, hey, blasphemy, blasphemy, blasphemy. Cursing it. Doesn't bother me. He's got his view of David. It's humorous. It shows how close, it's like love and hate. They're very close. How that someone can read the same word, and I really think the author is reflecting through David his own view. But it's humorous. How could you read it? Because it's humorous. It's looking with a different set of lens at the same facts. But what is amazing, I'm going through the whole book, I've only found three mistakes that he made. The man knows his Bible. And it didn't connect with him, except to have him write a novel, making David a grouchy old crank that thinks that God owes him more than he's gotten. And he thinks he's been underappreciated by God, and God owes him an apology. And because it's a novel, David can reflect on everything from Adam and Eve in the beginning, his view, and the way God treated them, and vice versa, clear up to modern times. He complains about his statue. Michelangelo didn't do him as good as he did Moses. And that's bad, because he had better lines than Moses. And furthermore, he says, I'm circumcised, and Michelangelo didn't show me circumcised. And he's angry that Michelangelo did a better job on Moses than he did on him. That's the frame of reference. And in one of his tirades, when he's frustrated because Bathsheba won't respond to his amorous advances, when he's absolutely sure that she can warm his old bones up, don't ever get the idea he's talking about God. Don't ever get the idea that he, that is God, made things easy for me. And see, the cover says, God knows, and it's got this little picture here where God talking out of the cloud says, go figure. Don't ever get the idea that he, that is God, made things easy for me. You want to read this? You know, I happen to believe I've planted your faith strong enough. This won't shake it. Well, it proves the point I've been telling you. God chose out from among those he didn't choose. And if you don't have the receiver, the transmitter's not going to register. Don't ever get the idea, David talking, he made things easy for me, referring to God. Life as one of God's chosen has never been a bed of roses. Ask Adam. Ask Eve. Give a look at what he did to Moses. And what happened to Saul. Now, God might have set things up for my encounter with Goliath, but I still was the one who had to kill him. I had to work and suffer like a dog almost all my life. I was nearly 40 years old before I reigned in Jerusalem, and everything I got I earned with the sweat of my brow. Joseph, given his history and his people, Joseph sheltered and preserved us. Of course, he's got a rendition on Joseph that's pretty good. Moses brought us to the border. Joshua took us in. But I'm the one that finished God's job. And God knows I think that he owes me at least something for the part I played in helping him reach his goal. Now, some of you need to look at this, and I'm sure I don't want to... This is a novel, and I don't want to misrepresent the author. He could be tongue-in-cheek, giving voice to the temptation we all have to gripe against God. At least I'm going to sell a lot of his books. I'm not selling them. We don't carry it. You have to go to Amazon or somebody. Imagine how he would rate today, God that is, if we had never even got here or been exterminated after we did. God wouldn't look too good, would he? And he also knows I expect to be rewarded before I die and not after. He owes me an apology, too, at the very least. I'm not saying I shouldn't have been punished for those sins I committed. I'm saying that the punishments he chose were inhuman. I read these lines the other night last Sunday, but this is going on now. I wonder what favor I'd want. I think I may be afraid to ask for it. I'm afraid he won't grant it. I'm more afraid that he will. Wouldn't it be tragic to find out that he really has been here all this time? God does have this self-serving habit of putting all the blame for his own mistakes upon other people, doesn't he? He picks someone arbitrarily, unbidden, right out of the blue. Now, staff people, listen. He picks someone arbitrarily, unbidden, right out of the blue, and I might add, most of the time they don't want to do it. The good ones didn't think they were worthy. He picks someone arbitrarily, unbidden, right out of the blue, so to speak, and levies upon him tasks of monumental difficulty for which we don't always measure up in every particular, and then charges us for his error in selecting imperfectly. He tends to forget that we are no more infallible than he is. He did that with Moses. He did it with me. He was gravely disappointed in Saul, but he sure guessed right with Abraham, didn't he? Our first patriarch. Now, Abraham was a prize. I am proud to be his descendant for reasons having little to do with his covenant with God or his being the first of our patriarchs. He himself did a little bragging about either. Sarah, his wife, is a favorite of mine, too. For her laugh and her lie. No pun intended. That'll hit you tomorrow. Abraham laughed also. Abraham laughed so hard he fell down on his face upon hearing from God that Sarah would bear a son, for she was already past 90. And it had long ceased to be with her after the manner of women. Sarah lied to God when he asked her why she had laughed. And she reminded me of Bathsheba at her best with her laughter and her lie, her penchant for mirth and her fondness for lively deceit, the convivial beauty in her youth. Sarah was a hellcat with other women when it came to protecting her own. Bathsheba was that way too, and I'd like to put my arms around her waist again and cling with my head resting upon her. Abraham dumbfounds me. He dumbfounds me still for having performed with apparent ease a feat of incredible difficulty. He circumcised himself. Do you want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Go on telephone. All right. No more calls. Hang up. Well, don't hang up. Finish the call. Finish courteously. Tell him to call back. My turn to talk now. I'm reading from Joseph Heller's God Knows, and he's right in the middle. It's a novel. Looking at Bible history through David's disgruntled eyes in his old age. When he thinks God owes him an apology and he hasn't gotten enough credit. It's a novel. It's not a true picture of David. And I'm going to say what I said in the previous half hour. Read Psalm 51. That's a true picture of David's attitude toward God. But this man knows his Bible, Joseph Heller, and it's funny. And he's a musician, David is. This is Grammy night. So you can listen to these modern musicians who don't really have all that much to say or listen to David. He'll give you a sort of a warped view of the Bible. Abraham. He's talking about Abraham. Now, he likes Abraham. Abraham was a prize, he says, and I'm proud to be his descendant. Abraham dumbfounds me still for having performed with apparent ease a feat of incredible difficulty. He circumcised himself. Now, this is not an easy thing to do. Try it sometime and see. As you surely must know, David talking, I speak with extensive, irrefutable knowledge of some of the mechanics of circumcision, acquired in the days of my betrothal to Michael, or Michelle, when I went merrily sauntering down from the hills with my nephew Joab and a band of stout-hearted singing volunteers to collect those 100 Philistine foreskins to pay to Saul in exchange for her. I know something about circumcising. It takes 6 strong Israelites, we figured, to circumcise 1 live Philistine. Oh, this next line, I don't think I want to go on. It takes 6 strong Israelites. It takes 6 strong Israelites, we figured, to circumcise 1. Ah, I quit. 1 live Philistine. It's the next line. It's the next line that's so funny. The job. Now, you're not going to get this at the Grammys. It takes 6 strong Israelites, we figured, to circumcise 1 live Philistine. The job turned easier after I... Oh, my goodness. Give me a song. I got to recover. Get on the telephone. Well, this is an inside joke. Otisville, Michigan. Doc, it sounds like the cows are back. Are you ready? All right, I'm reading from Joseph Heller, God Knows, a novel in which he imagines David disgruntled in his old age, still in love with Bathsheba, unable to be warmed by the Shunammite woman, the young lady they had given him to warm his old bones. Thinks God owes him an apology, and he hasn't gotten enough credit for what he's done for God. Not a true view of David, but it shows, I've laughed myself hoarse now, it shows how you can warp your view. And using David as a mouthpiece, criticize God for his treatment of you. Read Psalm 51. You'll have the true view. But he's now given a characterization of Abraham. He likes Abraham. He's proud to be his descendant. I'm going to read this line again, see if I can get to the one that stopped me. Abraham dumbfounds me still for having performed with apparent ease a feat of incredible difficulty. He circumcised himself. Now, this is not an easy thing to do. Try it sometime and see. As you surely must know, I speak with extensive, irrefutable knowledge of some of the mechanics of circumcision, acquired in the days of my betrothal to Michelle, when I went merrily sauntering down the hills with my nephew Joab and a band of stout-hearted singing volunteers to collect those 100 Philistine foreskins to pay to Saul in exchange for her. It takes 6 strong Israelites, we figured, to circumcise 1 live Philistine. The job turned easier. The job turned easier after I finally got used to the idea of killing the Philistines first. I got over that line. The job turned easier after I finally got used to the idea of killing the Philistines first. It did not cross my uncomplicated mind that Saul was setting a snare for me. It did not occur to him I might survive. Each of us had underrated the other, and he was more wary of me than ever after that, when he delivered those 100 Philistine foreskins. I had a wife, and he had the big advantage. He knew he wanted to kill me, and I did not. Even with the passage of so many years, and even with the knowledge that she helped me escape the blades of Saul's assassins, I'm unable to retrieve a single fond recollection of my long marriage to Michelle. Or Michael. Instead, welling up within me each time I remember her name is the same vindictive resentment I experienced for her the day she marred my triumph after I had finally brought the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem in a national and holy celebration about which everyone in Israel but her felt glorious jubilation. What a festival that was. That's the one where he danced naked, remember? This guy knows his Bible. What a parade I led. But she was a baneful person who spoiled my good days and rejoiced in my bad, and who would never allow herself to extol or admire me or to view me as most others did in the mythic dimensions of a hero king or as a huge monumental figure immortalized on a great pedestal of white marble. And that's another thing that bleeps me off about that Michelangelo statue of me in Florence. He got me standing there uncircumcised. Who the bleep did he think I was? If anything, the Michelangelo statue of Moses in Rome looks more like me in my prime than the one in Florence does of me at any phase of my life. Everybody says so. I wasn't that large, naturally, and I'm not made of marble. I have no scar on my shin or horns jutting from my head. But I had that same superior and sublimely articulated physique and that same unquestionable aura of immortal greatness and strength until I began to lessen with age, and they wouldn't let me go no more out to battle. Now, my weight has shrunken since. My hair is thinner. My beard is white. And my fingers palpitate with these recurring freezing seizures that often make my jaws chatter, that even Abishag the Shunammite, in all her virginal, firm, congenial loveliness, is powerless to alleviate while they run their raging course inside me, though she blankets me tenderly with all her body and rubs me everywhere with her hands and soft face. I wonder if she's old enough to know how majestic and virile I used to appear before my muscles wasted and I began to wither with age. Beneath the lotion scented with calamus and cassia, with which she freshens herself and the fragrance of aloes and cinnamon with which my servants perfume my bed, I can smell the coarse magnetic secretions of the natural human woman, and I want her, yet I don't. Bleep, bleep. I can't tell you this. I mean, it gets a little too X-rayed. Abishag! Lately, I've taken to calling her to lie with me even when I'm not cold. I feel better with someone than I do alone. Now that I've grown used to her, I'm starting to notice things. Certainly, her kisses are sweet. Her mouth's flavored with honey. Ain't getting this at the Grammys. Don't care what they do to try to top the Super Bowl. I can't go this one. I'm sorry. I kept going. Can't do it. You know, I lost all respect. I lost all respect for Jimmy Carter. He's written a novel, you know. And this is about on par with his confession when he was running for president that he had immoral thoughts in an interview with Playboy magazine. I just wonder if he thought he discovered those thoughts. Maybe he thought he was the first. And he's on Jay Leno's show, promoting his novel. And when you know, Jay Leno and Carter act like, you know, he's sort of embarrassed and splattered. And what it reminded me of is when I was a teenager here in a... I've always admired Carter for his life and always thought his wife should be president instead of him. But this, he couldn't seemingly figure out that Jay Leno was making a fool out of him. As Jay Leno says, there's a racy sex scene in this book, isn't there? And he grinned sort of embarrassedly. And then he got talked, not very, Jay didn't talk too hard. He got talked into reading the scene. And I thought to myself, Well, if you're trying to do a racy scene, this preacher could tell you how to write it better than you've written it, but it's such a corny. And furthermore, it was an adulterous scene where a neighbor and the wagon and the neighbor's wife get it on. It reminded me when I was a kid of the 10 or 12-year-old kid at testimony meeting that got up and says, "I want to thank the Lord for saving me from a life of terrible sin." You know, don't stoop to try to make contact with the world, that kind of stuff. But anyway, I can't read this. It's a lot more racy than Jimmy Carter's scene. Man, David knew how to get it on. He's talking about what he likes to do and can't do anymore. Man, he talks it better than most people do it. Got to find where I can come in again. Often I do want her to stay longer. It was I, for example, who first let her know with a concealed spasm of malicious delight of Adonijah's idea for his public feast. Now he's moving up to the problem he's having with Bathsheba because there's two sons vying to take his place. The son of David by Bathsheba, Solomon, and the other son, Adonijah. The rest of his sons have been killed. And so he's trying to spite Bathsheba and get from her what she don't want him to get from her. And he's throwing a feast for Adonijah. And now he's breaking the news to Bathsheba, he's having this feast, public feast for Adonijah. And Bathsheba's slouching listlessly on her cushioned bench. We've been out of this other scene where he's thinking about what he was sure he could do with the Shunammite woman someday. And Bathsheba's back on the scene, slouching listlessly on her cushioned bench with her long, I warn you, slender legs sprawling out. I'm sorry I couldn't read that page. This will probably sell more books than anything I've done. Sprawling outward in different directions and her finger absently winding her yellow hair, she pricked up her ears at that, improved her posture a bit, and concentrated tensely. The wicked flee when no man pursueth. The cynical see only cynicism in others. The guileful find guile when there is no guile. We both, he and Bathsheba, take for granted that my death, though approaching, will not come without warning and without leaving me sufficient time for final announcements. So it's much to her advantage to keep me alive until I change my mind from Adonijah to Solomon. Her long hair is golden again this week and deepens almost daily a shade closer to the ash gray that is her natural color, and that she will abruptly decide to obliterate by bleaching her whole head bright again. Not for my Bathsheba the wily tinting or delicate touching up with gossamer brushes. For 3 or 4 days there might be no word from her. Then she will come breezing in a flaring blonde again. The only one in all Christendom. See, he jumped from century to century. The thin spun hairs on her forearms must color to invisibility too. The hair on her legs she removes with hardened coatings of melted wax. She uses scissors under her arms. She is as cuckoo and self-seeking as ever. And I'm in love with her still. I don't believe now that she was ever in love with me, although she used to say she was, and I do believe she thought she was. Always, I believe, she was more in love with the idea of being in love, and especially, of course, with the idea of being in love with David the King. That much she admitted when she disclosed that her bathing each dusk on her roof in a place observable from my own had the premeditated goal of evoking my fancy and having me send for her. She hit the bullseye, that girl, the first time I laid eyes on her. We certainly did have a rousing good time of it during those first 3 wild years. The ghastly bad blending incredibly with the carefree and tempestuous good until Uriah and my baby were both dead and she gave birth to Solomon. Then it was over. Her lasciviousness cooled. She found instead the purpose of her life she had long been seeking, the career for which she had been hunting and unknowingly preparing herself. Let's name him king. She actually did suggest. When delivered successfully of our second child, a bouncing baby boy, God had relented and forgiven us, but I had not relented and forgiven him. I want Solomon to be king, she said. I can't read that next scene either. He wants to change it from discussing the king. How did I get on these pages? How did I get on this? I'm going to quit in a minute. Abraham again. What do you want with an old woman like me? After he finishes fantasizing, were the words of which with which Bathsheba refused me the last time I propositioned her. What do you want with an old woman like me when you have a pretty girl like her, Abishag? For as long as I've known her, she's been fashioning sequences of plans too convoluted to materialize and timetables for achievement too far-reaching to be met. Definitely she lacks the discipline of mind needed to impose some consistency on the lies she tells. I have a better memory for her duplicities than she has. Bathsheba lied about everything, told the truth about everything. Her lily-white face would flood a vivid scarlet when I caught her in one of those ruinous discrepancies into which I would guilefully conduct her, and then inevitably she would laugh from her whole torso without trace of misgiving, reminding me again in that impenitent and admirable way of the image I keep of Abraham's feisty Sarah, although Bathsheba has never been as plucky or as good-natured. Sarah had a much better spirit. Sarah, barren, gave Hagar to Abraham for procreation. Hagar, with child, despised her mistress and flaunted her pregnancy over her. She picked the wrong party. Sarah flew upon the uppity servant girl and drove her off into the desert. Not until the Lord appeared with assurances did weeping Hagar dare return. That was Sarah for you, our first Jewish mother, of whom I'm so fond and proud. Abraham, too, was remarkable. That's what I want, is Abraham. A father of many nations. God said he would make him, and kings would come out of him. His seed would be as numerous as all the stars in heaven and would possess the gates of his enemies. He knows his Bible. He forgot to add it would take so much time. Gracious and peaceful by nature, Abraham took up arms to rescue his nephew Lot from abductors and debated persuasively with God to spare even this one just man in the destruction of Sodom rather than to destroy the righteous with the wicked. He was already rich in cattle and silver and gold when the Lord appeared to him in the form of 3 strangers in the plains of Mamre as he sat in the door of his tent in the heat of the day. Had they been but passing Bedouins, he doubtless would have responded with the same instinctive hospitality, and he was the essence of gentility and etiquette when he invited them to wash their feet. Rest yourselves beneath that tree. I'll have some water fetched. He hurried inside the tent with instructions for Sarah. Make ready 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes of bread upon the hearth. Boy, he knows the details. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Then he ran to his herd and chose a tender calf and served with butter and milk. At that time, it was still okay to eat our meat with butter and milk. That'll hit you. Abraham stood by them while they ate in the shade of the oak tree. Wiping their mouths when finishing, they repeated to Abraham the information given to him once before that Sarah would bear him a son. Abraham was contemplative. Listening in the tent door, Sarah heard the prophecy. She laughed. God knew. Wherefore did Sarah laugh? Asked God. I didn't laugh, Sarah lied. You did so, insisted God. I know you did. What's the matter? You think that anything is too hard for me to do? Abraham and Sarah are the only ones I know of who ever got a laugh out of a conversation with God. Christ knows I could have used one often. I could use one now. But I know more than anyone that I'm not anywhere near the person Abraham was, or so willing and obedient a servant. Abraham was saintly, I guess, or stupid. He was prepared to go all the way along with God. When tested with the order to bring his young son Isaac up the mountain, build an altar, and sacrifice a child upon it, he was prepared to go all the way. My father, said Isaac, carrying the wood, behold, we have the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb to be sacrificed for the burnt offering? And look at the detail. He's right on the Bible story. And Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. Let's go together. Abraham built an altar, laid the wood on the altar, stretched out his hand for the knife with which to slay his bound son. Only then did the angel of the Lord call him out of heaven and reveal the ram caught in the thicket by his horns that was to be substituted for the boy in the sacrifice. Now, God knows I would not have done that, covenant or no covenant. When the notion arose in his head to kill my infant, he had to do the whole job himself. I knew I wouldn't lift a finger to help. I did all the praying and fasting I could to influence him to desist. There was no change in his mind. I lacked the genius to sway him that was congenial in Moses and Abraham. But Moses and Abraham were... You want me to continue? I don't think so. This is not as funny as the earlier, but it gets better. Get on telephone. I'm reading from God Knows. Joseph Heller, a novel about David with sort of a warped view of David in his old age, griping about the way God has treated him, thinking God owes him an apology. A distorted view of David, but this is a novel, and it's humorous. And I went through the X-rated stuff. I didn't know it was going to sneak up on me in these pages. And that's real humorous, too, but I can't read it on TV. You know, my sensitive ears are learning things I never, ever thought of. And we're down to the point where he's talking about Abraham again and his dedication in offering his son and saying he wouldn't do that, covenant or no covenant, and explains his anger that God killed his son born by Bathsheba, the first child. And he says, I was never pious or devoted. I'm not devoted to him now. God will have to make the first move if he wants to end this tension between us. I have my principles, and I too have a long memory. And he keeps giving the history of his predecessors. Abraham and Sarah laughed, and God gave them a son. They named their baby Isaac, which means he laughs. With Rebekah as a wife, Isaac sired twins. Isaac favored Esau, but Rebekah advanced Jacob, and I doubt Isaac laughed much when, dim of vision, with cataracts, but with a lip smacking in for savory venison, he recognized he had been hoodwinked into giving the blessing reserved for Esau to Jacob, who had disguised himself in goatskins as his hairier brother. Isaac then had to hear Esau's cry of universal despair that seems to me must pierce almost every human heart. Bless me! Even me also, O my father, Esau begged bitterly, lifted up his voice and wept. Hast thou no blessing left for me? Hast thou but one blessing? Oh, my father, bless me, even me also. So many times those same words could have been my own. Esau raged aloud against Jacob, swore to kill him. I'll crush his feet. I'll break his bones. Instead, when they next met, this artless man embraced with tears of love an unweakened family longing for the brother who had appropriated his birthright and his blessing. This was after Jacob, with immense trepidation, had sent ahead his four families and remained all night by himself on the safe side of the brook, where he wrestled to a draw until daylight with a cryptic angel who left him with a damaged hip, and told him upon leaving that his name would no more be Jacob but Israel. We still call him Jacob. He really knows his Bible, doesn't he? And I strongly doubt that Jacob, who was as smooth a man as Esau was a hairy one, did much laughing either. See, he's taken off on the point that he says, Abraham and Sarah are the only ones I know of who ever got a laugh out of a conversation with God. I strongly doubt that Jacob, who was as smooth a man as Esau was a hairy one, did much laughing either when he awoke after his wedding night and discovered that the girl inside the bridal veil and nightgown with whom he had lain in the nuptial bed was not the Rachel he had toiled 7 years to obtain, but the sore-eyed sister Leah. Rachel was beautiful and well-formed, and Jacob loved her from the day of their first meeting at the well. Leah had pink eye. 7 more years of indentured servitude to Uncle Laban were necessary before Jacob could have his Rachel too. Leah bore children quickly. Rachel had none. It was a little like the Sarah Hagar story all over again. Consumed with envy, Rachel thrust her handmaid Bilhah onto the mat with Jacob to conceive children as her surrogate. Leah counterattacked with her maid Zilpah, giving her to Jacob as a wife. With so many women playing such active roles, with this orgiastic contest of childbearing whipped up by these competing hot-blooded sisters of Haran, the poor patriarch found himself being bleeped silly 4 times a day. Found himself being bleeped silly 4 times a day. And it's a wonder his brains didn't go soft. I think I'm going to quit on that one. I think I'm going to quit there. I mean, you know, it's a wonder his brain didn't go soft. Everything else did. I may read that again someday. You've got to be nice to me for me to do it. Since we're in a laughing mood, I'll show you something real funny. You know, my wife, last one I sing with her, and that's always fun, but she also gets pretty tickled at music once in a while. You know, at practice, everybody's in there practicing after working a long, hard day. And you know, when you're tired, you start laughing, it's hard to quit. Since we've been laughing at this book, I think I'm going to play as I did before. You remember the last time when people got in a laughing mood at the practice on Saturday night? You know, if I'd open it up, we might get a bigger crowd on Saturday night at the cathedral than we do on Sunday morning. You want to see this?
Yes, sir.
They were trying to sing Up Where We Belong. Now, that song was written for our church when we first went downtown. Both the songwriter and the arranger, they won the Academy from an officer and a gentleman, but the song was written for our church. They were king's houses. And Melissa's trying to sing it with the band. And something happened. And I don't know what happened. I just see the results. Let it go. Well, I'm going to weaken in a minute and read some more Joseph Heller. You know, we ended it with Jacob, the poor patriarch, found himself being bleeped silly 4 times a day, and it's a wonder his brain didn't go soft. At long, long last, Rachel produced Joseph, then Benjamin. By that time, they left off. By the time they left off, the tired old man found himself with 12 sons and a daughter by 4 women. Embalming Jacob was the only thing left. Now he's going to tell us about Joseph. That's the next one. But you've got to get on the phone before I do it. I said I'd take 15 minutes, but I'm not. That may be the last section I read. One never knows, does one? David, a novel by Joseph Heller, God knows. A look at the history of the Jewish people and all the way back to Adam. Through the eyes of David, disgruntled and old, complaining that God owes him apologies. And he's got his self-respect. God has to come to him first. And he's sort of griping about the way God's treated people. He's not the first one that he feels has been mistreated by God, but he's the best one God ever had. Joseph, he says, the late-born favorite of his father, was already 17 when presented with a coat of many colors and old enough to know better than to go showing it off to his sweating older brothers, who were already resentful of the maddening partiality of which he was the spoiled and insufferable recipient. And Joseph had a dream. They were all binding sheaves. He stood upright in the center, and those of the others bent in abeyance. I've had worse dreams. And he dreamed yet another dream in which the sun and the moon of his parents and the 11 drab stars representing his brothers all dipped in the sky to bow down to him in homage. Another nice dream. But he was a dumbbell for crowing about it. I would have wanted to kill him too, and presto, they stuck him down a well, and abracadabra, all of a sudden gave a look, he was grand vizier, and the Pharaoh had made him ruler over all the lands of Egypt. So it all somehow came to pass, didn't it? It's almost as though God knew what he was doing. Only because they had sold him into slavery was he there in Egypt with the means to save them. Coming into his days, Joseph too asked that his bones be carried up out of Egypt to the land sworn by God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses saw that it was done. Joseph also was embalmed when he died at 110 in the very last sentence of Genesis. Embalming was not then a transgression of the Mosaic code, because we had no Mosaic code for another 400 years. All we had was a covenant with God that every century gave indication of having been from the beginning a very bad deal. Abraham kept his part of the bargain, but God made no tangible move to satisfy his end of the contract until the day he summoned Moses to the burning bush and told him, "Take off your shoes." Moses was standing on hallowed ground. Now there is the man I want most in all history to speak with. My affinity to Joseph is as nothing to the empathy, awe, and reverential admiration I feel for Moses. Why me? Was precisely the right question to issue from this startled, unassuming fugitive in the Midian desert. But Moses held him together and remained in God's good graces, didn't he? For 40 years, against every hardship and obstacle imaginable, God had provoked repeatedly, and was provoked repeatedly, by the people he had chosen. They moaned, muttered against Moses. The priest charged him with arrogating too high a station to himself. The sinners fornicated and worshipped idols. His sister and brother disputed his authority because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. As a matter of record, the marriage of Moses to the Ethiopian woman proved a compatible one. And just about the only time she ever raised her voice to call him a dirty Jew was after he had raised his voice to call her a nigger. Such tumult in that desert. Hardly had the Red Sea closed behind them upon the Pharaoh's chariots than they began to forget the stern taskmasters in Egypt who had made them serve with such rigor and had turned their lives bitter with such hard bondage. They remembered the flesh pots and the bread they'd eaten to the full, the leeks, melons, and cucumbers. In Rephidim, the people murmured against Moses because there was no water. "Is this what you brought us out of Egypt for?" they berated him. "To kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst?" God led them to water. He provided manna from heaven, an omer a day for every man, the tenth part of an ephah. And after 40 years of an omer a day of manna, the people were murmuring again and clamoring for more than just manna. "There's nothing at all but this manna," they cried. "We remember the fish which we had freely in Egypt, and the cucumbers, and the melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic. Who can eat so much manna? Is this what you brought us up out of Egypt for?" God supplied them, supplied them again with quail, then poisoned the flesh while it was yet between their teeth in a very great plague. Go figure him out. Bill this, bill that. Use this kind of wood for one thing, that kind of wood for another. Don't see the kid in the milk of its mother. Why? He isn't saying. He isn't saying. Spite work, if you ask me. Ask him. The people were as naked as pagans when they danced about the golden calf. An old man was stoned to death for collecting sticks on the Sabbath. Korah rebelled with his family of Levites for a larger stake in the priestly duties. They wanted the right to light the incense. The Reubenites rebelled. Many of the children of Israel turned again and again to the worship of other gods. A man brought a Midianitish woman right into the midst of the congregation to lie with her in his tent. And both were thrust through the belly by Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, who thereby, mercifully, averted still another plague. Miriam died. Aaron died. But Moses pulled them through. He was as nearly perfect as it is possible for a human to be. He asked for nothing, and nothing is what he got. I'm arrogant enough to wish I were as modest as he. And modest enough to know that this is arrogance. His face was aglow when he descended the mountain after seeing God, and the people feared to come near. He talked back plenty, too, and even once lost his temper with God when he heard the people weeping for food throughout their families because they were hungry. Every man in the door of his tent. The anger of Moses was kindled, and he demanded of the Lord, "God damn it, where am I supposed to get the flesh to feed them? Why are you doing this to me? What have I ever done wrong that you lay the burden of all these people on me? Who needs it? They're not my children, are they? That I have to be responsible for them and listen to them crying when they have no food? Where do I shine in? How much longer is it going to take? I told you I'd do it little by little," God reminded, "until thou be increased, lest the land become desolate because of the bugs and the beasts of the field multiplying against you. I warned you. I would do it not in 1 year, but 20, 30, 40. Moses protested with disbelief. "I just don't care anymore. It's too much. Just too much for me to bear. Forgive us and deliver us this minute. And if not, blot me, I pray thee, out of thy book which thou hast written. I'd rather be dead than go on this way. If ever I found favor in your sight, then kill me right now out of hand, instead of letting me see any more of this wretchedness." Give it to him, Moses. I want to cheer on whenever I recall his words. That's giving it to old God good. And the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do unto the people. But it was in response to this outburst by Moses that God sent quail until it was coming out of their noses, then followed it up with a disease while the meat was still unchewed. Who won? Who was right? I need some answers. I want to talk to Moses. I'd like to make him understand that just because I don't like my statue in Florence doesn't mean I don't like his in Rome or that I blame him for mine. His is great. I could use his advice. I'd like some tips from him on how to get along better with God. How to end this long silence between me and the heavens without sacrificing my dignity. Once, in utmost secrecy, recalling how Saul had succeeded through the witch of Endor in speaking with the spirit of Samuel on the eve of the Battle of Gilboa, I decided to have a go with the spirit of Moses. What could I lose? I knew I'd be violating laws and breaking commandments in whoring after wizards and witches and others trafficking with familiar spirits, but I was a king. I was desolate. I no longer had my God, and I felt like I was losing my grip. Without a God, you turn to things like witchcraft and religion. So I went to the necromancer, swallowed the powders, did the dervish, and crept into the cave. I repeated the magic words. Just one lamp burned. I put on the funny hat. I drew my hood close about my face as instructed and called upon the spirit of Moses. I got Samuel instead. I got Samuel instead. "Oh, Christ," I exclaimed in disgust. "What are you doing here?" "You sent for me," said Samuel, with the hollows of his eyes upon me. He was no less wintry in spirit than he had been in the flesh. "I sent for Moses. Don't butt in." Wouldn't you like me to tell you what's going to happen? I'll stop up my ears, I warned. I won't listen to a word. Get me Moses. I don't want you. He's resting. He's still very tired. Tell him I have to talk to him. I bet he knows who I am. He's deaf as a stone. Well, can't he read lips? He's almost blind now. His eye wasn't dim when he died. Well, he knows his Bible, don't he? Death sometimes changes people for the worse, said Samuel functionally. His stutter's back. His stutter's back, and it's as bad as ever. Tell me this, I requested, hanging on the answer before I'd even put the question. Where is he? Sitting on a rock. Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? There ain't no heaven. There ain't no hell. There's no heaven. There's no hell. That's all in your mind. He's really dead? There's a nail in the door. Then where is the rock? I asked, springing cannily to trap him. Where did you come from just now? Where do you stay when you're not up here? Don't ask foolish questions, answered Samuel. You want me to tell you what's going to happen to you, or don't you? I swear I won't listen. I've never been wrong. In my ears I'll put cotton, I won't hear a word. You told Saul he'd be killed in Gilboa, didn't you? And that Jonathan and his two other sons there would also be killed, and that the men of Israel would be scattered and forsake the cities and flee from them. Samuel gave a croupy chuckle. All came true, didn't it? That's why I won't listen to you. Why did he go down and fight after hearing you? Why didn't he wait them out in the hills and hit them from there? We're good at guerrilla work. He must have had a death wish. It was his destiny, David. That's... That's BS, Samuel. I told him that. We're Jews, not Greeks. Tell us another flood is coming, and we'll learn how to live underwater. Character is destiny. Friedrich Nietzsche would have understood, if character is destiny, the good are damned. Such wisdom is much grief. If I'd known my youth how I'd feel in old age, I think I might have given the Philistine champion Goliath a very wide berth that day, instead of killing the big bleep and embarking so airily on the high road to success that has carried me to the end of this low state of mind in which I find myself today. I've stayed away from him. The past has no value unless the present's good. And on the day of my killing of Goliath, who could believe it? Who would believe? Next chapter's on his accounting of killing Goliath. That's all you get tonight. Get on the telephone. Now, let me tell you about the cathedral. Between 9th and Olympic, on Broadway, right in the heart of the city, just a few blocks east of Staples Center. Exit on 9th, if you're on the 110, to one way, and go down to Broadway and turn right, and the cathedral will be on your right, and the cathedral parking lot on your left. If you exit off of the 10, get off on Los Angeles Street and go to Olympic and turn left two blocks and turn right on Broadway, and same thing, right there you are. We want people to come who want to be taught. It's that simple. So it's same as if I were teaching at the university, which is what I was trained to do, and you were allowed to audit or visit a class until you decided this is where you want to be. Now, you make the reservations here, and we mail you the pass. We need the reservations by Wednesday noon. And I hope that the volunteers are staying tonight and early tomorrow. We are, as I said, only about halfway where we normally are at this hour on Sunday night because I haven't opened the phones that much. So here we go again. Get on the telephone. Now, listen to me. Willie Brown, former Speaker of the Assembly, and one of the four who led this state to its great years, Richard Alatorre, Maxine Waters, Mike Roos, and Willie Brown. Term limits took him from the state capital, and he became mayor of San Francisco. He was here on my anniversary a couple of years ago. Willie and I are long time and old friends. We both connected years ago in our friendship with Greg Boutzer. He and I were one of the two speakers at Greg, one of the four, we were two of the four speakers at Greg's funeral in Beverly Hills. And the friendship has stayed firm through the years. Willie's going to be our guest next Sunday. He's always wonderful when he's here. And I thought you'd like to know that, God willing. Flu and many other things could change that. But he's scheduled to come next Sunday. So not only will we be teaching as normal, Willie will be there. And he always has something to say. He ought to be mayor of the world. Now get on the telephone, make your reservations. All right, no more calls. We're coming to station break time. It doesn't matter. I'm grateful to KDOC. Shortwave stations can say their little speech fast. I want to start something as we turn from the very humorous of this evening. To the very serious. The message today finishes Romans 3:25 and answers a question that was asked by G. Campbell Morgan in his wondrous and famous Westminster pulpit, one of the greatest Bible expositors of all time. I liked G. Campbell Morgan before I came here, but I'm always, I don't think the word's excited, respectful and appreciative that I'm preaching on a platform under the rooftop that has the Jesus Save signs, historic monuments, under which G. Campbell Morgan for several years preached. When in his senior years he was here in this country, have the flower pot where he stubbed out his cigar before he went to the pulpit. I thought I'd say that. And he preached a series of messages he calls The Problems of the Religious Life. The first message of the problems of the religious life. Has man anything to do with God? And he handles it pretty well. And he's amazingly up to date in his description of scientism. His second message in the series is relevant to the message that we're going to play in about 30 minutes as we replay the message or the service in its entirety, absent some preliminary comments to my congregation, as the curtain goes up until I finish the message. It's relevant to this question. I'm going to read him. Now I'm serious. I read the humor. The problems of the religious life. Can a just God, not can a God, can a just God forgive sins? It will be admitted at once that the possibility of the forgiveness of sins has been believed in and proclaimed by the Christian Church for 19 centuries. False deductions have been made from the central doctrine and false presentations of that doctrine in the process of these centuries. By false, I mean untrue to the earliest teachings of Christ and His apostles, as that teaching is recorded for us in the Scriptures of the New Testament. Perhaps the most glaring of the false deductions was that which is known as the Antinomian heresy, and it's still around, which was that because God has in grace provided perfect redemption, it does not at all matter how a man lives. Perhaps the supreme illustration, to go to the Catholic frame, of what I mean by false presentations was to be found in that most remarkable movement which preceded the Reformation and had its head center of exposition in Tetzel, who preached that by certain payment on their part, men might receive indulgence to sin. You know, we have, in the room of the book at the cathedral, one of a half dozen original copies of the 10 articles on this subject that separated the Church of England from Rome. Now we're crossing the station break. Speak fast, you folks on shortwave. And isn't it nice that 56 just has a little small K, DOC up at the top, K dot. Tetzel, who preached that a certain payment on their part men might receive indulgence to sin. These false deductions and false presentations, as well as the simple and I might say accurate proclamation of the New Testament declaration, do prove this. The idea of the forgiveness of sins has obtained in the Christian church from the beginning until now. And as I said a few weeks ago, quoting some modern views, God has to forgive sins because that's his job. The belief or the idea of the forgiveness of sins is based on belief in the government of God, the conviction of righteousness. Three things: the government of God, the conviction of righteousness, and the consciousness of sin. He goes into a long speech, reviewing his previous message, and in essence he's saying this second question is irrelevant if you don't believe in God, his government, and his determination of righteousness, and I agree with that. See God and righteousness, he concludes that by saying, and immediately, if you're honest, you will say, I have failed. I didn't do a long exposition this morning, I just said nobody in my congregation is stupid enough to think they're perfect. We've all sinned. Everybody wants God, if they believe in him, to forgive us. But the question is, can he be just? Can he be righteous? Can a righteous, just God forgive sin? He says, can a just God forgive sin? What do you mean by just? By forgiveness? By sin, he says. To discuss the subject, let's define the terms. What do you mean by just? Can a just God forgive? What do you mean by forgiveness? Sins. What do you mean by sins? Exactly as I would ask these questions if this inquiry came to me without the light of the Christian revelation. Seeing that the idea conveyed by the inquiry is a Christian idea, I must still ask these questions. What is the Christian meaning of the terms just and forgiveness and sins? Let's define our terms. First, what does the word just mean? If you take the word that lies behind it, and this is true, and examine it and attempt to discover, as you always will do if you're a careful reader, its root significance, I am not at all sure that you will not at first be somewhat surprised. The word out of which this comes is a word which means seeing. Let me suggest another word. Observing. You say at once that these two words mean the same thing. And yet the second of them is constantly made use of in a slightly different sense from that in which the first is always used. Seeing suggests a view. Observing also suggests a view, but it often means more. For instance, you say to a boy, "Here is a rule of conduct. Observe it." By which you mean to say you are not only to see, but to act in harmony with the thing you see. So if the root idea of the word translated just be seeing, its use means acting in harmony with the thing seen. Just means activity in conformity with things as they really are. Can a God who acts in conformity with things as they really are forgive sin? Let us be simple and childlike with our next word, forgive. What does forgive mean? To let go is the simple meaning. It suggests the idea of unlocking a prison house so that the prisoner is set free. The sense in which the word is used always means to treat sins as though not committed, to let them go, lock them out, pardon them, forgive them. Let me repeat my inquiry in the light of these definitions. Can a God who acts in conformity with things as they really are treat sins as though they had not been committed? For the third time, let us follow this line of definition. From the Christian biblical standpoint, it is almost more difficult to define words translated sin or sins in our Bible. I'm content to take the word that is most often translated sin, which suggests the simplest fact in the mind of the writers. It's a word which means missing the mark. I would add and say, more literally, falling short. Firing a gun, that bullet falls short because the mark is out of range. It's the word used of a man standing with his rifle and shooting at a bullseye and missing it. Yeah, it has that too, but most of the time, falling short. It is a word which indicates the failure of the man who sets himself to realize and never realizes. He misses the mark. Falls short. To fail, whether willfully or unwittingly, is in the broadest sense of the word sin. Let me make my inquiry again. Can a God who acts in conformity with things as they really are treat missing of the mark, and I'm adding falling short, as though the mark had not been missed? That's the problem of this inquiry. Let's take the two ideas. First, the idea of justness of God. What is justness? We've already said it's seeing things and observing them in the sense of being true to them. Let us now put it in this way. Justness is God in God. Justness in God is undeviating conformity to truth in himself and in his dealings with others. Take the phrase forgiveness of sins and the idea suggested by it. What is meant by the forgiveness of sins? The treating of failure as non-existent and the treating of the one who fails as though not having failed. That is forgiveness in the biblical sense. Someone is saying, "You're making the problem more difficult than it seemed." Well, I hope I am. If you try to understand what forgiveness means, but what you do with your children, you will never understand it at all. If you begin to argue that just as you say to your child, "I forgive you," so God does with a sinner, you do not begin to know what the Bible teaches about the forgiveness of sins. That's not the forgiveness of the Bible. You cannot make the sin of your child as though it had not been. And that's what the word really means. In order to persuade ourselves that God can forgive, We're losing the amazement that ought to fill the heart in the presence of the meaning of the cross and His infinite grace and forgiveness. The first thing that overwhelms me is the problem. Then the thing that overwhelms me more is the solution of the problem, which the Bible teaches and for which the Christian church really stands. Having spent so much time with the definition of terms, let me now try to state the problem. Here are certain self-evident things that I submit to you and pray you to follow me and not to be afraid. As to God, to treat sin committed as not committed is to act not in conformity with truth. Let me repeat it. To treat sin committed as not committed is to act not in conformity with truth. That is unjust. As to the universal order, to treat sin committed as not committed is to establish and confirm sin. It must rule. That is unjust. As to the sinner, to treat sin committed as not committed is to establish and confirm sin as a power in the life not to be overcome. That is unjust. Now the problem can be stated by only first making a fundamental affirmation. A just God can forgive sins only by basing His judicial action upon absolute truth. If the forgiveness of sins means the violation of truth, then God can never forgive sins. Can God so deal with sin as to enable Him to forgive it on the basis of absolute truth? That's what the message is about in the service to come. The hilasterion, the place of mercy, the one who came and was made to become that place of mercy, who said, "I am the truth." You may say, what's his answer? Well, here's where G. Campbell Morgan began to disappoint me, just like Andrew Murray and others. He goes through a description of the Lord Jesus Christ as God, and he says, you say that does not explain it, and I admit I've never yet had it explained. It lies beyond me, surging upon my spirit in billows of unfathomable love that almost break my heart, yet eluding the grasp of my mind. One of the few times G. Campbell Morgan disappointed me by going into that spiritual gibberish, woo, 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 beyond human comprehension. Paul explained it. That's what we've been teaching, and we're not done yet. In Romans 3:21 through 27 and down to the 31st verse, after he finishes the long sentence. That's what we're teaching in Romans. Paul explained it under the inspiration. God explains Himself, how He could righteously and justly, in conformity with the truth of His own declarations, painful as it was, and give us a place of mercy. And amen, so be it, the forgiveness and still be just. That's the subject of the message in today's. I'm not willing to just engage in spiritual shibboleths and hallelujah inducing phrases like a politician who uses mother and democracy at the right time. God intended us to know and to grasp and be able to say amen to what he says amen to. I hope you'll stay tuned until about 20 minutes from now we take you into the service and let Paul explain how a just God can forgive sin and has been doing it since Adam. Get on the telephone. You know, I decided here on the spur of the moment, I got him scurrying around back in the VTR room. I said, can you find the tape when Willie Brown, he was still mayor of San Francisco then, the term limits forced him not to seek another term, and his term as mayor of San Francisco ended last November, I think it was. And I talked to him yesterday. I said, Willie, you don't have to be mayor of San Francisco to come see us. He said, I'll do it. Now, hold on. Don't start him yet. Don't start him yet. I'll tell you when to start him. If you got him ready, that's all I was to be told by you. You got him ready. Because I wanted to give you a sample of what it's like when Willie's at the cathedral. And he'll be there next Sunday as my guest. And you know, he's not in office anywhere now, so Willie can say anything he wants. This is the way he was. He wasn't too much inhibited last time. This is the way he was when he was at the cathedral last time. Let's go.
Thank you. 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 Thank you very, very much. Dr. Eugene Scott, the members of this congregation, I am delighted to be here to celebrate the 27th anniversary of Gene Scott being at the helm of this august institution that reaches so many other places on this globe beyond the confines of Los Angeles. When Dr. Scott invited me to come visit with you, it is not my first visit. It was maybe 8-9 years ago, before I became mayor of San Francisco, that I was here. He told me which date was the anniversary, and that's the date I selected. Part of my duties as mayor is, of course, to represent the city wherever the city needs to be represented. And on this occasion, the city needed to be represented in Colorado Springs, Colorado, because that's where some very uninformed voters was cast in the ballot as to who ought to be the Olympic city for 2012. I said uninformed voters because they didn't select us. So be clear. But I was there and I made the pitch. I made a hard pitch. New York was there with Giuliani and all those other people, Billy Crystal and lots of other people, and they just overwhelmed us and they won it. But it was snowing and sleeting and raining, and I knew I had to be here. So I left, went to the airport, got on one of those little puddle jumpers of an airplane, and he said to the gentleman that got on as the pilot after I'd gotten on, was a brother. Well, now, you know, I don't like to fly anyway. And I am a victim of America's teachings and America's education. And people that look like me are not supposed to be flying, you know, airplanes.
Oh,
so, you know, while I want to be with it, I want to be respectful and all those kinds of things, I wanted to say, brother, where did you get your training? How many times have you flown these things? Did you ever fly in snow? Well, now, that shows you how victimized I am. And I suspect you would be as well in this society. Because if it had been a white man going into that cockpit to fly that plane, I wouldn't have thought anything about it other than my continuous nervousness about flying. Because I don't understand, you know, what the deal is. There's no flapping or nothing like that. It's just two straight pieces of board that sticks out there and runs down and gets fast enough and it lifts off seemingly. I'm always worried it isn't going to lift off. But I tell you that story because America is gripped and still in the grips of being victimized by us drawing conclusions about each other based upon who we look like, color of our skin, whatever accent we may have, how we may wish to worship. And America and the world is still in those grips. However, there's a ray of light that comes out of America that challenges that on a daily basis, an hourly basis, a minute basis, and that's Dr. Eugene Scott. He challenges that. He challenges that. Now, I'll tell you the story. Now, long before I had the privilege of shaking his hand and being introduced to Dr. Scott, I used to flip on my television set. I can't sleep at night. And I used to sleep a couple of hours and then I'm awake. And, you know, nobody wants to be bothered with somebody who needs a full conversation at 2:30, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. So I was reduced to literally flipping on my television set. And I flipped on my television set and I saw this dude sitting on a stool with a leather hat, a leather jacket, a white beard, and talking stuff, real stuff, in a way that seemed to make sense. And I thought, what a wonderful opportunity. And I didn't pay any more attention to it, listened to that show and turned it off. The next night I flipped it on, and there he was. And then one afternoon I flipped it on, and there he was. One morning I flipped it on, and there he was. I figured that I had to meet him, because I had to be the only person in the world that slept less than I slept. And then, in those days, they didn't have all this internet stuff where you can flip on and search and get in people's business without them even knowing you in their business. I had to actually make an effort to find out who this guy was. First found out he was a Stanford PhD and proceeded to become a pastor, ordained minister, Protestant church, and had a church in Glendale, and then ultimately a church in downtown Los Angeles that was on radio worldwide. And I started following him. And I realized as I followed him that he covered more than the BBC covered. And I love the BBC. I love that time, the moment with the Prime Minister. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that, but that would be right up my alley. I've never heard such polite insults being heaped upon people. And I kept thinking, you know, in the world, if it was organized right, the parliament is a great setting for talent like Dr. Eugene Scott. Can you imagine exchanging with those members of parliament and all those members of parliament? Well, the BBC broadcasts, and it broadcasts worldwide. More people listen to Gene Scott. Voice of America prostitutes itself in many cases worldwide. More people listen to Gene Scott. And so I decided I had to get to know him. I had to see what he was about. And what I discovered, as I've gotten to know Dr. Scott, something very, very profound. I don't think Gene Scott is of our world. I think the Lord really had something extraordinary in mind. And I tell you that since I've gotten to know him, he's been an incredible inspiration for me in my own world. When term limits was generated in such a way that it looked like I was going to be without a job, I started thinking, now, what would Gene Scott do? The folk have been after him for years. They don't want him to broadcast. And every time they say no, another satellite goes up and another image goes up. Every time they say no, he moves from English to Spanish. He moves from Spanish to Portuguese. He moves from Portuguese to French. I mean, he's just all over, and all over the world. So I, with that in mind, said, now, there's got to be something. And sure enough, when they said, you're out in Sacramento because of term limits, I start thinking, what would Gene Scott do? He would look around for an opportunity to see where he might be needed. And it's what we ought to learn from him. Well, I did. I looked around, and there was a mayor in San Francisco, and he appeared not to be doing the job. It was just legitimate. He was kind of, you know, he should have been somebody's driver, maybe. But he clearly didn't have the presence of being the mayor. Gene Scott's never invited him to speak here. So you just, and that kind of has to be the standard. So I accepted the challenge to go take the man's job. I was going to do it, you know, in the interest of all of us. And now I didn't know anything about local government. Absolutely nothing. I always thought local government should be abolished. I didn't think there was any reason for local government. I was in the high and mighty state. Well, the first debate, of course, everybody is looking at me as the 1,000-pound gorilla with this awesome reputation nationwide and all the credentials of what I've done politically, etc. I go to this debate, and you can't get briefed on things like how to fill potholes, repair street lights, or do all the things that you do at the local level. I know nothing about any of that. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I am absolutely praying, Gene, that the Lord will not give me the first question. That the first question will go to one of my four opponents. And sure enough, the question first went to the mayor, the incumbent mayor. Well, he spent all time not answering the question. It was about housing. He talked about me. And I mean, he really talked about me. He talked about everything that I'd done and everything I'd voted for and every contribution that I'd taken and everywhere I'd been, who I'd supported, and everything under the sun. One of my aides leaned over and said, you're going to answer that, aren't you? I said, no way. He's telling the truth. I mean, there's no way I can answer that. But he had not answered the question. Then they go to this lady who was from HUD, Housing and Urban Development in Washington, D.C., and she had been writing on a yellow pad full time, never lifting her head as things around her were swirling. So I decided, maybe I should listen to see what she says. And sure enough, she never looked up. When they got to her, she read what she had written. Nobody in the audience heard her except one, me. It was the best answer I'd ever heard. And I knew right off I was stealing that answer. No question what I was going to do. I was going to steal that answer. Then, Dr. Scott, they went to the fourth person. And the fourth person had spent full time, while everybody else was speaking, waving and throwing kisses and doing those things, which means she had a very short attention span. My guess is that she didn't know and wouldn't know what the question was. Well, she turns to me, sure enough, and says, "What was the question?" Well, I wasn't in the pulpit. I wasn't in church. I wasn't under oath. So I didn't have to tell her what the real question was. She sounded like an utter fool. Everybody started looking at her because, you know, I think he said something about who won the World Series or something. And she started answering.
That really. I want to tell you. We're about to go into the cathedral. He's out of a job now. So, I want to talk with him. He'll talk to you on Sunday. We're going to have a good time together discussing opportunities. I love the guy. He came down when Pasadena threw a birthday party for me many years ago, and he and Lon Cook spoke. Willie is always wonderful to be with us. He'll be there next Sunday. Now, it's only 2 minutes until we go into the cathedral. They'll play part of a song that gives you a minute or two to call and make a reservation, and then we'll take you into the service this morning as it occurred. Make your reservations for next week. Willie and I will be there. Willie will be a good... He'll be fun. Get on the telephone.